Stem cell science is changing medicine and our understanding of human development. Learn more with the Stem Cell Channel. Visit uctv.tv/stemcell.
We have been interested in primarily mechanisms of leukemogenesis when I started my lab, but that really quickly, based on some of her work and certainly Irv Weissman's work and others, took us into the fields of stem cell biology and then chromatin biology. Much of it's been the work has been focused on this KMT2A or MLL. There are two names for it. I can't stop calling it MLL, but I'm supposed to call it KMT2A. So you're going to see both terms throughout the talk. A lot of the work is really focused around this particular complex, but we think and hope that this has the potential to impact other types of cancers as well. I'm going to talk mostly about leukemia today and just at the end tell you some of the other cancers where we think these mechanisms are relevant. These are my disclosures. The reason I'm here in San Diego is this company that Ben Ebert, Phil Chamberlain, and Eric Fisher and I started a few years ago. I was at their SAB yesterday, but it has nothing to do with what I'm going to talk about today. The only thing that's relevant for today is I'm going to be talking about menin inhibition, not so much in NPM1 mutant AML, but I'll mention that. Importantly, these are the people that have done the work, five very talented postdoctoral fellows, three of which have their own labs now, and Pablo and Wallace hopefully soon as well. So this is the outline, and maybe obvious, but I'll start with a little bit, 10 minutes or so of background, kind of how we got into what we're doing and kind of right up to what we're doing now, and then talk a fair amount about mechanisms of resistance to small molecules that target this particular chromatin complex, because I think it's interesting therapeutically, but I think it's going to be interesting from the biology standpoint as well. And then maybe this looks backwards, but the mechanism of response. It's, you know, when we get to the point where we have an FDA-approved drug, often people think, well, the story's over. There's an FDA-approved drug. Most of the time, this group probably knows this, we still don't understand how a lot of those drugs really work. And I'll even say that we know how that we got to where we are with the menin inhibitor, but there's still plenty to learn as to how it's working and why there's a therapeutic index. There's always been concern that if you wipe out chromatin complexes, that should or could be quite toxic. So all this work starts with this particular protein, KMT2A or MLL, the wild type version of MLL is shown here schematically. It's a 500 kilodalton nuclear protein, a very large protein that's in a complex here, which with multiple other large proteins. This is a monstrous complex, which has made biochemistry complicated over the years. It has multiple domains. The one that's been focused on the most is this histone H3 lysine 4 methyltransferase, so-called SET domain, because it's homologous to the trithorax genes that had been studied long before MLL or KMT2A in Drosophila. And I like to point this out, that much about what we know about mammalian MLL biology was predicted from the genetics of Drosophila. People tend to forget the power of that organism, and it certainly set the stage for what we know in the mammalian systems. Clinically, this became interesting because it was noted in the 1980s by Clara Bloomfield and Janet Rowley that there was a chromosomal abnormality at that time on chromosome 11, Q23, that predicted a poor prognosis in infant ALL. That's kind of how I got into this, because of that interest. And it was shown that abnormality predicts or is found in AMLs as well, and also often predicts a poor prognosis there. And then in the 90s, the breakpoint was cloned by Stan Korsmeyer, whom I did my fellowship with, and a number of other labs, including in the Rowley lab, about at the same time. And what these translocations do is essentially make a fusion protein where the N-terminus of MLL invariably fuses to the C-terminus of some 100 different fusion partners. And that's kind of where we were when I started this 20-something years ago. We knew that what the fusion looked like, didn't know too much about what it did. And the first period, I'm summarizing the first 10 years of work here, and was really when you put the MLL fusion cDNA or protein into various hematopoietic cells, what does it do at the gene expression level, at the cellular level? And what we were able to show through a number of papers is that when you introduce the MLL fusion either into hematopoietic stem cells in the mouse or so-called granulocyte macrophage progenitors, these committed progenitors here, you can transform either of those cell types directly, and the resultant leukemia has a self-renewing leukemia stem cell that looks more like a granulocyte macrophage progenitor than anything else. This was following certainly in the footsteps of some of the work Katrina did in Irv Weissman's lab. And importantly for us, we could at that time, this was the day of microarrays, define the gene expression program that the MLL fusion was driving by comparing leukemia stem cells to all these various populations. And essentially what this leukemia stem cell is a committed progenitor that's inappropriately expressing some few hundred genes that are normally on in stem cells and shut off during myeloid commitment. And that was so-called leukemia stem cell associated signatures, the signature we've used now for about 15 or 20 years trying to figure out how we turn that signature off with chromatin complex, or by targeting chromatin complexes, and that's what I'm gonna get into the details of here in a minute. All while we were doing this, other labs, not us so much, were doing a lot of the biochemistry trying to understand what are the other proteins that are taking part in this driving the gene expression program that we had defined. And 10 years or so of work there led to this schematic, which actually is maybe not surprisingly a simplified version of what the MLL fusion protein complex looks like. So this is the MLAF9 fusion protein generated by the translocation, bound to a protein called menin. I'm going to talk a lot about that. And another protein called LegF. So this is the N-terminal part. This also is found in the wild-type MLL complex as well. And then the C-terminus, AF9 in this case, is bound to two different complexes. This is probably not one complex. The DOT1 complex, that's a histone H3 lysine 79 methyltransferase. And the so-called superelongation complex with CDK9, which most of you probably know, is a kinase that phosphorylates RNA polymerase II to drive transcription. So what you have is a hybrid complex that's not normally found as one, held together by the MLL fusion. And this is a slide to show you how much small molecule discovery has gone on in this space. Each of these red labels is a different small molecule that's been discovered and in some case developed clinically to target various components of this complex. And I point that out primarily to point out that this degree of drug discovery for a disease that's probably 1,000 people a year in the United States is really unusual. And the reason for that, I think, is because when you get to this level of understanding of the mechanisms of what's going on, or at least we think we understand it, it's a little bit easier to convince biotechs and pharma to actually dig into this problem to try to discover small molecules. Now that statement's about 5 or 6 years old. I'm not sure today it would be as easy as it was 3 or 4 years ago, the point being that there's been a lot of drug discovery or small molecule discovery in this space. We focused for quite some time on this enzyme DOT1. Everything I'm gonna tell you about the menin inhibitor in terms of biological effects is almost identical to what you see with the DOT1 inhibitor, but for various reasons, the small molecule discovery efforts there got delayed and the menin inhibitor became much more obvious in terms, at least for biotech, in terms of ongoing discovery. So I should point out that menin as a dependency, an important part of the MLL fusion, was discovered by Mike Cleary's lab, by Akihiko Yokoyama while he was a postdoctoral fellow there in the Cleary lab in the early 2000s. And Yolanta Grimbecka, an outstandingly talented chemical biologist at Michigan, in fact made the first small molecule menin inhibitor binding to the pocket on menin where the MLL protein associates, really showing the biotechnic world that this actually could potentially be done. So that's when we were approached in about 2014 by a small company then called Vitae Pharmaceuticals, now called Syndax Pharmaceuticals, where they said, we think we can make a drug like molecule that binds to this menin pocket. This is the pocket on menin that should disrupt the MLL menin interaction shown here schematically. And in fact, they were able to do that made very good potent and selective small molecules. We helped them characterize it primarily by asking, are we really effectively reversing this gene expression program that we think is critical for the MLL fusion-driven leukemias? And it turns out the answer to that was yes. Here's some of those genes that we know from studies, various studies, that are an important part of this MLL fusion or self-renewal-driven program. And the way that it works is when you disrupt this interaction, the MLL fusion comes off of chromatin, but at selected loci, it doesn't get removed everywhere. And I'm going to get into details of that, the mechanistic aspects of that in a minute. And I think this is probably why there's a therapeutic index. So anyway, we published this molecule, VTP-50469. You move one methyl group from here over here, and you get the small molecule Syndex 5613, which is now called revumenib. So we published that in 2019. This is the type of preclinical data we were able to generate with this small molecule. For those of you who've done these types of experiments, you know that survival curves that look like this with a new small molecule are very unusual. Two reasons for that. One, mechanistically, we think this is a quite effective way. Two, this is an extremely good small molecule in terms of its pharmacokinetics in mice. And three, we can put it in the chow, and the mice get continuous levels of the small molecule, and you get, in fact, eradication of the MLAF9-driven mouse AML. And for those of you who study this, you know that's an extremely aggressive mouse model. So the primary effect of inhibition of menin is to induce differentiation of the leukemia cells. They ultimately die, but that is not the first step in the process. We reverse the gene expression program, part of it, as I told you, removes MLL from select loci, and we get dramatic responses in human PDX models as well. So that was enough to drive this to clinical development. I'll tell you briefly about that in a minute. While we were doing that, and this is when we were still at Sloan Kettering in New York, Michael Kuhn, a postdoctoral fellow in the lab, asked the question as to whether or not menin might be playing a role in other types of leukemia. And why did we think that might be the case? Well, this gene expression program that's centered around the HOX genes and this gene MEIS, the transcription factor MEIS1, is actually expressed in about 50% of all human AMLs, the most common subtype being the ones with mutations in the nucleophosmin-1 gene. I won't get into the details of the mechanisms of this, we'll just get to other things. But so Michael and then Hannah Uckelman looked at this, and in fact, menin is a dependency there in NPM1 mutant AML. And we actually now know, we're able to show, that the mutant nucleophosmin protein is binding to chromatin as well, which is not a normal function of nucleophosmin-1, and activating essentially the same set of genes, relying on the MLL complex and menin to do that. So this work then prompted the addition of NPM1 mutant AML to the groups of patients with leukemia that might benefit from such. And other than mechanistically, the interesting aspect of this took this now from about 1 to 2,000 patients in the United States per year to some 17 or 18,000 patients in the United States per year. And the amount of interest in biopharma quadrupled at that point. So there were rather two companies. There are now 6 or 7 different menin inhibitors in clinical development. So this is just showing you that the menin inhibitor releases the MLL fusion from chromatin. When we treat MLL rearranged leukemias, the same thing happens in NPM1 mutant leukemias. And this is another subtype of AML that's only found in pediatrics, fairly rare, but incredibly deadly. NUP98 rearranged AML, same mechanism, or at least same outcome, that is the fusion protein binds to chromatin and the menin inhibitor reverses that. So this is some 40 to 50% of AML. That led to clinical trials. Phase 1 we published now a couple of years ago, led primarily by Gus Issed, MD Anderson, and Eitan Stein at Sloan Kettering. And these were the response rates. So an overall response rate of about 50%, with a composite CR rate of about 40%. And for those of you who've been involved with clinical trials in relapsed refractory AML, this is quite impressive and was impressive enough to the FDA to lead to the approval of revumenib, the molecule I was telling you about, for the treatment of KMT2A rearranged AML in the relapsed refractory setting. And we think later this year, it's two different menin inhibitors, both revumenib and one from Kura Oncology, are likely to get approval in NPM1 mutant AML. We'll hear about that sometime in November or December. So this is going to be, that again really increases the numbers of patients. So now the next steps. As all of you know who work on targeted therapies in cancer, single agent targeted therapies, at least small molecule targeted therapies, rarely by themselves lead to cures of the disease. They may lead to long periods of time of remission. In fact, there's one patient that's been on a menin inhibitor for about 3.5 years without any side effects and remains in remission. That's not the most standard thing. The most standard is about 8 or 9 months, and then the patients will progress. So we knew that was likely to be the case. So Florian Perner started asking, well, if cells are going to become resistant to menin inhibitors, how is that likely to happen? And he used this approach, which at the time was new. It's becoming a little bit more used more in more widespread use now. But this was a base editor screen across the length of the menin locus to basically make as many single nucleotide mutations as we could in a pool. Worked at the Broad Institute doing this with them. They were developing the technology at the time. So you put that library into cells, treat them with the menin inhibitor, and basically say what grows out. And then you can capture the guide, see what it targeted. And we found this. In 2 MLL rearranged cell lines, we were selecting for guides that mutated this asparagine, this serine, this glycine, this threonine. Here's a second line, asparagine 136, threonine 349. That all seemed interesting, but I have to say it was new. This data was a little bit noisy. We weren't entirely sure what to make of this. It looked pretty cool. And then I got a phone call from our friend and colleague at Sloan Kettering, Ross Levine, saying MSK has been sequencing essentially, and they still do this, every patient sample with a panel-based screen for all cancer rather than just leukemia. So menin was on their panel. It was not on our panel at Dana-Farber. And he said, we're starting to see mutations arise in patients, menin, in patients progressing on the menin inhibitor. And I said, well, what amino acids are they? And he said, they're amino acids glycine 331, threonine 349, and another methionine 327. That's one of those moments when you know you've got a story that people are going to be interested in. So we did all the work to prove that those mutations both induce resistance and how. And this shows how at the molecular level for one of the mutations. So this is the methionine 327, in this case mutated to isoleucine. That's the most common mutation, at least at that time, and I think to date still probably is the most common mutation that develops in patients being treated with revumenib. And essentially what that does, this is the crystal structure of wild-type menin in green, mutant menin in gray bound to revumenib, the yellow being the wild type bound to wild type menin, the purple here, the revumenib bound to the mutant menin. And essentially what happens is that mutation changes the conformation of this part of the binding pocket just enough to create a steric clash that changes the binding affinity by 50 to 100 fold. And it's that single 70 angstroms that is the difference between life and death for these particular patients that develop these mutations. So this both is interesting from a molecular and biological level, but this really validates menin as a therapeutic target in leukemia or in cancer when they go to the trouble of making these types of mutations that lead to less binding. Turns out these mutations are found in patients that have MLL rearranged AML and NPM1C mutant AML. I have to say, up until that point, there was still a fair amount of skepticism in the field that NPM1 mutant AML was likely to be a therapeutic opportunity, but this pretty much put that to rest because, again, this is pretty strong validation. It also means, and we all already knew this, that combinations are very likely to be needed and or next generation menin inhibitors, and both of those things are moving forward. I mentioned to you, and it's interesting, won't get into it today, but the sociology and psychology of drug discovery, because we had worked on Syndax and revumenib, essentially everybody else said, well, that happens with revumenib, it doesn't happen with our inhibitor. Well, it depends on how hard you're looking, if either it's going to happen with their inhibitor or not. So we decided to do our base editor screen now to much higher resolution with all five menin inhibitors, and that's shown here. And what this is doing is showing you all of the various amino acids that were mutated that led to some degree of enrichment in the presence of any individual menin inhibitors. And the red boxes are the ones where you're getting dramatic selection and then ultimately resistance as assessed by validation experiments. So you can see this methionine 327 here basically makes these cells completely resistant to menin inhibitors. Glycine 331 as well tends to affect most of the inhibitors, but not all of them. So this is J&J's small molecule. It's not affected at all by this particular mutation. And then some of the inhibitors have very specific amino acids. We have not seen these yet in the clinic, but I suspect we will. Either lysine 367 or glutamine 368, I can tell you why there have to be two there if you want to hear about that later, but and valine 372. The point being that there's a core group of mutations that tend to induce resistance to all, most, if not all, the inhibitors, and then each of the inhibitors has its own specific type as well. But I will point out that it looks like the J&J molecule is the least affected broadly by this type of mutational resistance. We'll see how that plays out in the clinic, but needless to say, they like that statement. But these mutations lead to a relative decrease in binding affinity, which what that means is if you could get a high enough, perhaps, if you could get a high enough concentration of the menin inhibitor in a mouse or in a patient, you might still be able to treat that leukemia. You just have to use a higher dose. So Wallace decided to do this experiment, which, as you can probably see from the days of treatment, could only be done by putting the inhibitor in the food. You're not going to find anybody to treat mice for 250 days. And so what Syndax did for us was to make chow that had increasing concentrations of the menin inhibitor embedded in the chow, and 0.1% gives you levels that are most similar to what we're getting in patients, and 0.3% somewhere on the order of three times higher levels. And he treated and asked in this PDX, what happens when you increase the dose? And this shows you the human cells and the mice over time. And you can see here for the mice that received 0.1%, this is when they relapsed or when they progressed. And almost all of them had mutations in menin. So this is the mutational form of resistance I just told you about. But if you could just give three times the dose, now one, the survival is prolonged. And now actually you're very rarely getting these types of mutations, probably because you've gone over the threshold. And it's a different type of resistance that happens out here. So it's a non-menin mutational type of resistance. And this is just shows you what this is now starting to characterize these leukemias a bit. So this is a vehicle-treated leukemia. These are maturation markers for myeloid cells. And you can see the leukemia doesn't have much in the way of maturation. And then you treat here with, and this is the 0.3%, this is the high dose. So these mice that are still alive, they ultimately do die, but whether they're dying with or from leukemia is a little bit hard to say. But the cells in their bone marrow look very differentiated. So at least is assessed by CD13 and CD14. So the point being, high dose leads to a differentiated phenotype, but those cells are hanging around and the mice ultimately do die. So what's happening to that gene expression program that I've told you about in these mice that have been treated for a long time but have these so-called persister cells there that look differentiated? That's what this RNA-seq here is looking at. So these are this is a part of the menin program that we know is relevant, or we think is relevant. And here are the vehicle-treated mice, the Hox genes that I've told you about, a number of other genes. These are myeloid differentiation-associated genes down here. What you see in the mice that are treated with the low dose, which didn't respond, is we got no effect on that program. What you see in the ones where the mutations developed is you're no longer having an effect on that program because the inhibitor is not binding to menin. But these ones here where you have persister cells, where the cells are surviving even after 200 days of treatment with the menin inhibitor and look differentiated, the menin program, or at least this part of the menin program, actually is shut off. So the menin inhibitor is still doing what it generally does, but but the cells are maintaining themselves in some way to persist in the bone marrow of this mice. And these are all cells taken from the mouse bone marrow. But they're still leukemogenic, because if you take them and put them into a secondary recipient mouse, it'll kill that mouse in 30 to 45 days. So they're leukemia-initiating cells sitting there, not doing much, held in check to some extent, whatever that means, by the menin inhibitor, by suppressing this program, but they're not differentiating and they're not dying, but they're not actively causing leukemia at the time. So this is a what in the clinical terms we would call an MRD state of persister cells that are maintaining themselves some way in the presence of the menin inhibitor, even though this program that we have used for years seems to be repressed. So what's the, I've already told you this a little bit, but just a little more characterization of these persister cells in these wild type, we've sequenced them, they don't have menin mutations. And I'll go through this in some detail. So these are the vehicle mice, right? This is now looking at two myeloid differentiation markers. These are the mice, the leukemias that develop these mutations. Menin inhibitor doesn't work there. They're immature. But these mice, the leukemia cells in the mice that were treated with the high dose that don't have dramatic infiltration of their bone marrow with leukemia, usually around 5%. You can see here relatively small numbers of cells. But they, again, look fairly differentiated. So Wallace and Megan Abolio in the lab decided to start to, and this story is certainly not complete, but this group would find it interesting, start to try to determine where the leukemia-initiating population is in these cells, or in these leukemias. And I have to say, I might have thought, and maybe Katrina would have thought differently, that you put this amount of pressure on a leukemia over time, you might paint the leukemia into a corner where there's not too much heterogeneity left in terms of functional heterogeneity. I would have lost that bet. And because when they sort the CD14, CD11 positive cells, so these kind of appear the most differentiated cells, and the CD14, CD11 negative cells, it's those 14 negative, 11 negative cells that are far and away the most aggressive. And we haven't done limiting dilution yet, but probably have the majority of the leukemia initiating cells. Here's the more mature cells. They will ultimately lead to leukemia, but these 11 negative, 14 negative cells are where the most potent leukemia initiating activity is. The point being, there's still some significant degree of functional heterogeneity with immature cells being more aggressive or able to recapitulate, transplant the disease, and mature cells that have less of that activity. So we did what everybody else does these days, is we did single cell RNA sequencing on two of the vehicle mice and two of the these persister mice, and you can see them here. The two mice have, at least at this level, persister leukemias that look very similar. We're still analyzing this data, but here's the RNA-seq for those markers that I just told you about, CD14, CD11b. And CD11b doesn't contribute much to understanding the heterogeneity, but you can see here this CD14, there's clearly a population of negative cells and positive cells. So we think the leukemia initiating activity is highest in this group of cells here. And with that, we can now look at the program, in this case, MEIS1, representing the gene expression program. And what we start to see is that actually in this CD14 negative population, there are quite a few cells that still seem to have MEIS1 expression. So if that's true, and we've done it now in a couple of settings, and it looks like it's holding up, bulk RNA sequencing would show you that MEIS1 is suppressed, but single cell RNA sequencing is showing you that there's still, it appears, a subset of cells in that persister population where we have not completely repressed the menin program. So if that turns out to be true, that's both important clinically, but biologically really interesting. Why would it be the case that the menin inhibitor shouldn't work or can't work in that subpopulation of cells? This is just a characterization of gene expression programs associated with proliferation. I'm not going to get into too much detail because we haven't really characterized this in great detail yet, but at least some of the cells in that population look like they're cycling. Whether or not the cells that are transplanting the disease is cycling, I don't want to make that statement. I'll get myself in trouble. But we do have some work there to try to understand that. And then finally, I think this is interesting for a number of reasons, but this is data here on the left from a paper from John Dick's group working with Charles Mulligan, where they did single-cell RNA sequencing on large numbers of samples from AML and then projected that single-cell data onto normal single-cell RNA sequencing from normal hematopoiesis. And they were able to show that various types of leukemias look to be either arrested or derived from different populations. And they were said in the setting of MLL, rearranged AML, there are at least two different types, a progenitor-associated type and something closer to a stem cell-associated type. That was satisfying for two reasons, because that's what our mouse model had said 10 or 12 years before this, but also now we can start to characterize our persister cells in the context of that thought process. So what do I mean? So here's a PDX model treated with the vehicle, so these are our controls, and you can see that the majority of the leukemia cells are mapping to this GMP monocyte, early promonocyte, this kind of granulocyte macrophage progenitor stage. And there's some degree of differentiation coming out from that, but this looks to be perhaps the apex. When we treat and get the persister cells, we've moved the vast majority of cells from this progenitor state to a much more differentiated state. These are so-called CD14 monocytes. I've shown you CD14 marker was the best, at least the ones we've assessed, way to determine this heterogeneity, but they've left some cells behind. So basically what I think this is telling us is that, okay, there's a hierarchy, we know this from all the work over the years in AML, where you have leukemia-initiating cells and more differentiated cells. We treat with the menin inhibitor, we've moved the vast majority of the cells out of the leukemia-initiating population here to a more differentiated, likely less leukemia-initiating or maybe no leukemia-initiating, but we leave some behind. And trying to understand what we're leaving behind and why is obviously a major part of the effort going forward. So for the resistance part, this is where we stand. There's a genetic form, as I've told you, where you mutate menin, just the small molecule no longer works, essentially. Companies are trying to now make second generation to see if they can get around this. And there's a non-genetic form of resistance, persistence. When does something become a persister versus a resistant cell? It's a fun discussion in the lab, but the point being, there is a population of cells that for whatever reason, most of the time, maybe not all the time, we're unable to eradicate. And of course, we're interested in what those are. So in the last, probably 10 minutes or so, I'm gonna shift, this is still about menin, but shift gears in terms of the question. And I've been alluding to this throughout the talk. So we know from all of our model systems, have a really good idea of where the MLL fusion is bound to chromatin. Depending on where you draw the ChIP-seq lines, it's somewhere around 200 to 300 genes that the fusion protein is driving. And with systems like DTAG, where I bet some of you here have used this, where you can degrade a protein, engineer a system to degrade a protein, and then look very quickly at what happens when you do that, we know which of those genes are really, really dependent transcriptionally on the MLL fusion. So that kind of sets the stage. This is, we think, the group of genes that are most likely to be relevant. This is a heat map showing, in the context of these genes, what happens when you treat with the menin inhibitor. And I've been alluding to this. You can see the menin inhibitor shuts down a component of the MLL fusion-driven program, not all of it. And that shows you here. So these are some of the genes you've heard me talk about. MEIS1, CDK6, MEF2C, these are all genes we kind of know to watch out for in these types of experiments. The HOX genes have always been a little bit of a conundrum because they often respond, but very slowly. It's not the same type of response that we get here. And there's some part of the MLL fusion program that couldn't care less about menin. And so why would that be the case? This is just another part of the phenomenon that's related. Make this clear because I'm going to make a point about it in a minute. When you treat with the menin inhibitor, menin comes off of chromatin everywhere, gone. You can see that here by ChIP-seq. The MLL, this fusion protein in this case, is an MLL rearranged line, comes off of chromatin at these genes where the expression's going down, MEF1, MEF2C, MEIS1, JMJD1C, but not the HOX cluster, and that's one of the ones that doesn't respond. So the point being that the MLO fusion depends on menin to bind to a select population of loci, but not others. And there was no understanding as to how that distinction could or should be determined. So that's the question. Why does menin only affect inhibition only affect a subset of the target genes? And can we determine sequences in the DNA that might be associated with this phenomenon? And giving a little bit away the punchline here, the standard motif analyses that I bet all of you have done at work on transcription factors certainly did not pick up anything. When we started using machine learning approaches in collaboration with Rafael Irizarry's group, head of data sciences at Dana-Farber, we now think we actually have found a sequence. It's not a motif, it's a much larger than that, but a sequence and maybe structure in the chromatin that is associated with menin inhibitor response or menin dependence. So how do we do this? Well, first we did ShipSeq, we've done that 1,000 times, and so there's some 75 to 100, depending on how you count it, loci that have tremendous amounts of menin associated with them compared to the others. So that's our menin-bound set of loci. And then you start looking in that using machine learning, saying, are there any sequences associated with those regions in the genome or any structures of sequences that are enriched there related to other places in the genome? And then the next question will be, is that associated with the response to the menin inhibitor? I told you the traditional motif analysis didn't show anything, but this convolutional neural network approach did, and basically what it showed us is here. So I'm going to go through this picture in some detail. So this is a known MLL fusion target gene, PBX3. Here's the ChIP-seq for MLL, bound over so-called CPG islands. This is a region around many transcriptional start sites that have been defined for quite some time. It's known that MLL associates with those through a particular domain. Here's menin, and here's LEGF, another protein that's bound in this three-protein complex at the N-terminus of MLL. But you can see that menin spreads out and LEGF spreads out, MLL does not spread out. Under that, in the sequence, is the CPG island, that should have been there, and it is, and a region of highly enriched for AT or ATA or ATT nucleotides, so either two or three A's and T's together. So Pablo calls these an AT flank that are super enriched in the intron of this gene, PBX3. So that is that combination of CPG island and regions of AT richness, dinucleotide AT richness, is very unusual and is associated very heavily and really predicts the menin, highly menin-bound loci. This is another version of that where you have the CPG islands are kind of spread out across. They're not one CPG island, they're multiple. And the AT flanks are not a long stretch. They're basically distributed through here. And it turns out that this distinguishes two different types of menin-bound loci and MLL-bound loci. Those that are responsive to the menin inhibitor here, and those that are unresponsive to the menin inhibitor here. And I'll skip through this and get to this. This shows you that phenomenon basically in using both sequencing and ChIP-seq. So this is in blue are the menin high targets. In gray are all the other loci. Here is the sum or the size, the amount of that AT richness downstream of the, in this case, of the transcriptional start site. And this is loss of MLL from chromatin when we treat with the menin inhibitor. And basically what you can see is the larger this green stretch gets, that would be going up on this, the more MLL you lose when you treat with the menin inhibitor. So the point being this structure, and I'm gonna show you it's actually a 3D structure of it in a minute, this is CPG flanked by AT richness is associated with the importance of menin. The beauty of CRISPR is we can do the functional experiment and say what happens when you take that chunk out. Just take out this piece of the intron that has this AT flank and you lose expression of PBX3. So that part of the locus that part of the intron is playing some role in supporting expression of PBX3, and this is a region where menin and VEGF are spread. Interestingly, when you cut that piece out, you lose KMT2A up at the CpG island, you lose menin, these are all proteins we know are associated with menin MLL bound loci. So not only do you lose transcription, you lose a lot of the complexes that are associated with the transcriptional start site, but we didn't affect the transcriptional start site in terms of sequence. And you lose RNA-Pol2 association and acetylation. But you don't lose H3K4 trimethylation. So what does all that mean? What it means that there is something about this region of this intron that is supporting the transcriptional start site by helping maintain a group of chromatin complexes that we know are important for the expression, but it's not completely destroying the structure of the transcriptional start site when you take out this region. Needless to say, this suggests that there must be some, or could be some, physical interaction between this part of this gene and the transcriptional start site. So we worked with Tom Milne's group in Oxford, who's interested in these types of things as well, and used a very high resolution version of Hi-C essentially, but it's a capture approach, micro capture C, where basically you have you target a particular area and ask with very high resolution what other parts locally of the genome is that bait region associated with. So here's an example of that type of data. So this is now MEIS1, and this is the gene we're most interested in. It's a little bit complicated because its structure, for whatever reason, most of the most dense CpG island is a little distance from the transcriptional start site, but just downstream. So we basically had a bait right there. And you can see here that there's interaction, this signal here is interaction between this bait and other downstream and upstream portions of the gene. I would say when I first see a new technique like this and you get this type of signal, a little skeptical as to exactly what it is you're looking at. It's a little hard to interpret what all this means. But what we found when you treat with the menin inhibitor, a lot of this signal, at least over these AT flanks, goes away. And this is what happens at the vast majority of the loci. And this is exactly the region where menin is spread. So we see this at multiple loci, and what we think this is telling us is there is interaction between the CpG islands and the AT flanks, and when you treat with the menin inhibitor and lose those complexes, now this structure, called microloop or whatever we haven't come up with a name with it, is lost. And that is associated with decreased transcription. Probably decreased transcription because then what happens later, once this is exposed, is the polycomb complexes come in and shut it off completely, but that takes time. What we think this is telling us is that these set of loci, all of which are critically important developmental loci, most of which are transcription factors, have a unique 3D structure around their transcriptional start site that's being held together by menin, MLL, and KMT2A. And when you start to disrupt that, and we can disrupt it in other ways, that structure starts to fall apart and the high-level transcription that you get decreases, and ultimately that allows the polycomb complex to come in and silence the gene, which is probably what happens during normal development, but we haven't gotten to that yet. And we're just starting to do experiments to really look. There are now, as most of you probably know, high-resolution single-molecule live cell imaging that you can do to watch this process, and we're setting that up to be done now. So I'll end last bit of data here with this thought, and I have to say we've almost purposely not gotten into understanding the biology of so-called transcriptional condensates. There's a lot of people working on that, and I think it's both fascinating and likely relevant. But with what I've told you, it really suggests that you've got this structure of lots of chromatin-associated complexes that are probably in very high local concentration. And the best way to do that would be to form a condensate and bring everybody together around these transcriptional start sites. And the way we looked at this is actually endogenous tagging of the MLL fusion using CRISPR in three different cell lines, this case with HA, and an antibody to menin. And red is the MLL fusion and green is the HA. And you can see that kind of right off the bat that certainly there are puncta there. It's probably the case that these are condensates. And we can measure the amount of overlap, if you will, between the MLL signal and the menin signal. That's shown here. So 80% of the time, but as assessed by the imaging, when you have MLL, you will also have menin. But when you treat with the menin inhibitor, you lose that association. So the menin inhibitor is actually disrupting the interaction between MLL and menin and somehow affecting their localization at these condensates and at the same time disrupting that interaction, the chromatin interaction that I told you about. And we don't know what this means, but it's fascinating. The MLL fusion actually moves from one type of condensate to another. So it's lost its anchor, if you will, in menin, and now it's gone off into another type of condensate, and what it's doing there, we're still looking at. So the point is, I think this is basically really supportive of an idea of MLL, menin, and a number of other complexes driving transcription. You start to disrupt them, the whole complex starts to fall apart over time, and this condensate starts to either lose some of its members or completely fall apart. We haven't looked at that yet. And that is important for the high-level expression of these programs that we've been studying now for quite some time. So this is here for me to point out. I've been talking about the MLL-menin complex throughout the whole talk. We know that everything I've told you, essentially, other than the condensate part, we haven't done this yet, is the phenotypes would be almost exactly the same if we inhibited DOT1 and histone H3 lysine 79 methylation. We also know and recently published that there's another complex, histone acetyltransferase complex, so-called MAS or CAT6A, that if you inhibit that, you get very similar outcomes in terms of gene expression. And if you look across the Broad dependency map, which you probably know is a large set of data of some 700 or 800 cell lines that have had genome scale CRISPR screens done on them. Anytime you have dependency on one of these complexes, it's almost guaranteed that you'll have dependency on the other complexes as well. So we think these, at least these three complexes, are working together to control and maintain this elaborate chromatin structure that is allowing for high level expression, probably normally during development, and probably tunable expression during development, but the leukemias have found a way to take advantage of that in at least 50% of the cases to drive that gene expression program. We think these mechanisms, while controlling different gene expression programs, are probably important in other types of cancer as well. And we've recently reported that menin and CAT6A and actually DOT1 as well, those complexes are very important for estrogen receptor stimulated gene expression. So if you probably know how these experiments are done, but you take breast cancer cells, for example, and starve them of estrogen, treat them with estrogen, and within 6 to 12 hours, you'll get a huge explosion of transcription. That's the ER-driven transcriptional program. And if you inhibit menin and or CAT6, better if you inhibit them both at the same time, you essentially completely suppress the ability of estrogen receptor to drive gene expression. And that combination, at least in preclinical models, really seems to have activity against estrogen receptor-driven breast cancer, both organoids and PDXs. And we found something similar in a type of sarcoma. So maybe it's not surprising, but I suspect for various types of either developmental or lineage-associated transcription programs, these complexes will be being used in those cases as well. It does lead to the question that I'll answer that we don't know the answer to before somebody asks it, is why is it there's not more toxicity of this approach if you're actually inhibiting those programs in other cell types? We don't know the answer to that yet, but it does look like there's at least some possibility that these mechanisms could be relevant for other types of cancers. So, summarize, the menin-MLL complex is a now approved therapeutic target in one subtype of AML, maybe to be approved soon in others. Maybe up to 40 or 50% of cases could be affected. And acquired somatic mutations is one major way. This happens in about 40% of patients. You'll see the acquisition of some type of menin mutation, and that there are other mechanisms of resistance, kind of an adaptive form, if that's what that is, that we're still working on. And I think for a crowd like this interested in stem cell biology, I think that the functional heterogeneity that is still there after we think you've hit the leukemia pretty hard, right at the program that we think is supporting self-renewal, that functional heterogeneity gets maintained. And whether that's because we just weren't good enough at getting all the cells, or the cells or the leukemias are adapting in some way, is still to be determined. And then we think that why the menin inhibitor is working is it's really maintaining a unique chromatin structure at least in leukemia, at a very critical set of genes. And we've luckily perhaps tapped into that when we treat with the menin inhibitor. And perhaps as we all go forward studying this, we'll find other ways to use this information and these therapies in other cancers. So I'll stop there. This is the lab. These are the people currently in the lab. I mentioned the people who've done most of the work. We collaborate very closely with Eric Fisher on all of our biochemical and structural biology work. Told you about Ross's input. We have tremendous collaborators throughout the Harvard Medical School system. And I think I will stop there, and obviously happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Right, I have a question. You'll see you'll have a litany of questions. Two very short questions. MEIS1 has splice isoforms. Have you looked at that as a mechanism of resistance?
We haven't yet, but we should. You're right, and you're going to keep asking me that if I don't. So, you're right. We haven't looked at it yet.
Okay, tour de force. Thank you. And I had other questions, but I'll ask you later, and I'll take this to.
Thank you. Amazing talk. So two quick questions as well. So the first one is, what's the prevalence of those menin mutations in the normal CD34 positive cells? With the question in mind, whether the menin inhibitor actually select for those mutations. But if they are de novo mutations, and you showed really nicely the menin inhibitor changed the chromatin, have you looked at the menin chromatin structure around that gene itself, whether it makes it more or less sensitive to gain those mutations?
Yeah, that's a good, I hadn't thought about the second part of that. So the first part of the question is we haven't, it gets to the question as to whether or not these mutations are you know, always there and we're selecting for them, or they're de novo. And it's an extremely difficult question to answer. So at the level of detection that we can do by sequencing, we can't see them. We've never seen them in a non-menin inhibitor setting. And then we start to see them some month or two after we start treating. So I take that as it's probably the de novo, and they're just, it's a very rare event, but there's so much pressure on the leukemia that it doesn't take too long to select for them. You know, an experiment that might get at this a little bit, I presented this once at the Broad, and I don't know if you know Bill Sellers, who was, you know, the head of Novartis oncology for some time, said, you know, we had this same problem in BCR-ABL whenever we came up with imatinib. How do you get to the answer? He goes, one thing you should try to do, and we had not been able to generate these mutations in vitro in cell lines. He said, put 10 times more cell lines in, and his argument was that allows for more replication events and therefore more potential mutations, and you'll see them. And he was right. We do see them now in cell lines, but I'm not sure that actually answers the question. So it's a rare event, whether or not it's happening all, you know, they're there, and it's just a matter of...
the second part of the question that maybe indeed...
It is. You're right, and given the fact that we know there's a unique chromatin structure there, it's possible that that could be more mutagenic. It's a good idea. We have not looked at that.
Awesome talk, thank you. My question was a little bit back in the beginning. I might have missed it. For the second group, the second subtype of AML that's being focused on for drug development, NPM1C mutant, that's just relapse and refractory NPM1C?
For the approval, for the potential approval?
Yeah.
So for now, the approval for MLL rearranged was only in relapsed or refractory, and it'll be the same for NPM1. The upfront trials are certainly now ongoing. The goal, of course, is to get them into newly diagnosed patients, but that's a much slower process to get to from a clinical trial standpoint.
Yeah, and especially for NPM1C, I feel like, you know, not much pressure for that, given that their prognosis is quite favorable. And so if all the work has been done in relapse and refractory, like, has anyone looked at if these MLL fusion subclones exist in the initial cancer, or are these truly a response to treatment and then they appear?
The MLL fusion, so the
in NPM1C specifically.
Yeah, no, the MLL fusion is not present in NPM1C mutant AML. What happens is when you get the mutation in nucleophosmin 1, which, as you probably know, leads to export of nucleophosmin 1 to the cytoplasm, that binding to XPO1 or CRM1 actually also at the same time allows it to bind to chromatin. So it actually, two things happen in that mutation. The mutant NPM1 binds to chromatin and it gets transported out, which is what you look at most of the time because that was known for quite some time. And then that binding to chromatin is using a similar, probably not identical, mechanism to drive gene expression. So it's basically the mutant NPM1 becomes something like an MLL fusion in its function.
Hi, really elegant work, and I love the work on the dose response to the menin inhibitor and mutation development. I was wondering how that could, what the implications for that could be for clinical trials. I mean, we're normally looking at safety, tolerability, then eventually efficacy. How can we take into account that, like, higher doses may be required to prevent resistance, which we're not always looking at in clinical trials initially?
Yeah, it's a difficult question for multiple reasons, not the least of which is the FDA doesn't like that thought process. Meaning, and it sounds like you know this, they're very focused, and appropriately, I guess, at times, on getting to the minimally effective dose and not going much higher than that. But I'm worried for targeted therapies like this, that particularly ones where the cells don't immediately die, that could be a problem. I mean, how to change anything at the FDA today, I don't know. But so the bottom line is, I'm not sure how to answer your question because it's a complicated regulatory question, and the biotech companies don't want to deal with it either. So I don't know. If you can figure that one out, you've done some good.
We'll keep thinking about it.
Great talk, Scott. Oh, so I have a couple questions. First, for the persister cells, that's wild type, are there any other mutations?
Yeah, it's a good question. So there are some that pop up here and there, but nothing that's been consistent enough for us to be able to pin that phenotype on new mutations. So you do see RAS mutations now and then get acquired. And I think people are probably seeing that in the clinic. Whether or not that's what's driving this phenomenon, I think the answer is probably no, but we can't say for sure. But there's nothing else that's particularly consistent.
We're 5 minutes over, but I'd like to thank Dr. Armstrong for giving a tour de force presentation. Thank you so much. Thank you.